You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us.
Welcome to another hour of looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory. And I'm Anne, your host, and Kevin is your other host, coming in loud and clear from Taree. Hey, Kevin.
Anne, yes, I'm here in Taree, and this will probably be the last time I'm doing the show via my phone from Taree. I'm going to start heading south back down to Melbourne soon, but via Canberra and Tokemoal on the way through. It's getting hot up here, Anne. It's that was the whole purpose, was to escape the Melbourne winter.
And now you're complaining about the heat.
Yeah. Well, the mid-coast of New South Wales is the Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, not too cold. But I work physically and outdoors, and it's warm. So it's up in the 30s here at the moment.
I can hear the birds.
Well, I'm sitting next to the Manning River, and it's just lovely. There's so much space up here in the country, you know. In the city, and everything's crowded in, but out here it's just quite lovely.
Well, I'm going to meet you halfway on your way back to Melbourne, because I've been thinking about our little trip up to Canberra. The pub night crowd are going to head up to Canberra.
Public Money, Public Good Forum?
Yep.
In Canberra?
Yeah, so the pub group has turned themselves into a group called Public Money, Public Good, and we will be holding a workshop, which is a half-day workshop, there in Canberra on the Saturday, 1st of November, 1 to 4pm, and that will be at 71 Leichhardt Street, Kingston. So if you would like to know more about that event, or you want to pass it on to someone you know who lives in Canberra, just head over to publicmoneypublicgood.net. That's the website. Or you can search for that event on Humanitics as well. And I'll be speaking at that event.
I'm going to be the techie. I'm going to be doing recording and stuff, recording this for posterity so that we can use it for our future shows, which would be good. Hey. I'll tell you something which I've been figuring out while I've been here in Taree. It's good living in different places and the rest of it. Mm. So Taree is a country town, and these are national voters up here. This is National Party stronghold. And I've been in Taree for a few months now, and I really like the people in Taree. They're lovely people. But, there's racism everywhere. I've certainly come across a lot of racism in Melbourne when I've been door knocking for elections in the past. You know, you speak to somebody and you're talking to them, and then it just pops out, you know, like, oh, so many immigrants here, it's making life hard for us. Mm. And for me, it's always been like a challenge to think about, well, how do you approach somebody who's like this? Because some of the people that I'm dealing with here, I've become friends with, you know, and they're nice people, they're good people, but they continue this line.
So how do you reconcile that?
Well, okay, so I had somebody the other night, and they said, oh, you know, yeah, how you going, blah, blah, blah. Oh, it's a great place, rah, rah, rah. You know, a pity about all the Muslims. And I'm going, well, what's the issue with the Muslims? And he goes, oh, they're coming in here, and, you know, there's not enough jobs, and it's hard enough as it is. So I said to him, and I'm trying to practice as I go along, I said, I don't think they're the issue, mate. I said, the issue is we've got half the world's wealth held by 1% of the population. Mm-hmm. If they shared their stuff more, well, these immigrants might need to have to come here to find a better way to live. But if they did, we'd probably be so well off that we wouldn't worry anyway. But there'd be plenty to go around.
And how does that go down?
And it went down okay. What he said after that was, oh, you know, yeah, these bloody foreign wealthy people. I said, I'm not talking about foreign wealthy people. I said, I'm talking about Elon Musk. I'm talking about Gina Rinehart. I'm talking about people that we all know, you know, Zuckerberg. I said, they got way too much money. He said, imagine if they shared their wealth. You know, how much wealth does a person need? And then I went on to say, and the only way you can make them share it is if the government makes them share it. This is the point.
Yeah.
The government is in control of the distribution of wealth,
yes.
And they allow these people to become super rich, and they allow them to exploit us so that we all start fighting amongst each other. And he engaged. He was engaged in the conversation.
I do think the point is that we don't have an immigration problem. We've got an economic problem.
Yeah, we've got a scarcity problem that has been contrived by the super wealthy to keep us all serving
fighting
them
each other.
And fighting amongst each other.
That's right.
So all these good old boys and the rednecks and the rest of it, they're good people. They're Christians.
They've just got their causality a bit askew.
Well, they've been fed this propaganda. This is a strategy that's been used by the wealthy for decades, is to get us all fighting over the scraps.
You're a great model for reaching out across the divide there, Kev.
Well, I'm rowing with these people. I'm working with these people. And so rather than get into a fight with them, I'm trying to divert their minds back to the real cause of this.
Speaking
quality.
Of diverting minds, Kev.
Yep. Have I been ranting for too long?
I was going to say that today, this episode, we have got a first for Radio MMT. And that is that we've got our very first guest interviewer in the form of James Rosier.
Our roving reporter.
We've got a roving reporter finally.
Excellent.
So James has appeared on Radio MMT before as a guest, and that was in our episodes 36 and 47, which you can go back and have a listen to wherever you get your podcasts. But today, James is going to be speaking with Marcus Champ. Now, they're both graduate-level students of the Economics of Sustainability course, which is offered by Modern Money Lab via Torrens University. And you can find out more about that course at modernmoneylab.org.au. But it's all about transition, Kev. It's all about making this just transition from our current extractive, exploitative, civilization-threatening, biosphere-destroying fossil fuel economy to a post-carbon, degrowing, circular economy that sits within planetary boundaries and leaves no one behind. So how are we going to make this radical change to our economy? And I think radical change is probably one of the scariest phrases in the English language. But the thing is, we heard in our previous episode of Radio MMT, we got a big hint from Colin Long, who's a Just Transitions organiser at Victorian Trades Hall Council. And he and other speakers at the New Economic Vision Forum were talking about if you combine a job guarantee with a four-day working week, you'll be headed in the right direction, but also you might get a campaign that maybe the folk up in Tarikev could get behind.
Yeah.
But as you and I were talking about after that episode, while something like a job guarantee is essential to a well-being economy, it's not the only tool that the government has in its toolbox. So if we want to totally transform our production and our consumption, you might be wondering, well, what are these other tools and how do we know whether they'll work? And these are the big questions that we will be looking at with James and Marcus. And I believe it was as a part of their coursework that Marcus took the lead on exploring what governments have done in recent history when they have been faced with steering the nation through an existential crisis of similar magnitude. And of course, that crisis was a global war. So let's hear from James and Marcus.
Okay, Marcus, welcome to Radio MMT. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, James. It's always exciting to be part of Radio MMT. The crew there are fantastic.
Now, Marcus, today we're going to be talking about the wartime economies, specifically World War II, and with a focus on the Allies' side. And for a lot of the Radio MMT audience. Talking about war might put them a little bit off. And I want to just, before we get stuck into some of the specifics, to dig into that a little bit. What is it about the wartime example, the transformation that occurs in the economy there, that's such a good example for us when we think about issues of today and about resources use in general?
There would be four high-level arguments I'd make around this. Firstly, the last, 70 years or 50 years or so, there's been a couple of key messages that have been reinforced throughout that period. Markets know everything. Markets are supreme. We must follow whatever the market wants. Governments shouldn't interfere, and they're subservient to the markets anyway. You know, government budgets must be sustainable, inverted commas, and always conform with market expectations, that inflation is always a monetary problem, that states in general are subservient to the markets and should do what the markets want, and that's how you get the best outcome. During the war period, it was done in a completely different way. And sort of it draws some history to say, you know what, there are other ways that this could be done and that we should look beyond the propaganda as to what's real and what's not. So that's one aspect. Another one is that the war period, especially from an economics viewpoint, money was subservient, was secondary to the resources. And just like with modern monetary theory is very strong, obviously, around focusing on fundamentally, it's all about resources. I mean, another aspect is around that, you know, over the decades, there's been a very distinct ratcheting down as to what governments can actually do. Not only governments shouldn't be interfering, but they're not very good at anything anyway, and whatever they do will always fail. To wrap it all around as well, here is a distinct period that was an existential crisis to our very existence in a number of different ways. You know, if that regime that we fought against did what it wanted to do, which is essentially conquer the world, we would be in a very, very dark place. The resistance around that, you know, what governments can achieve and how we can build a different future, especially given the potential of the oncoming climate crisis. There's a lot of lessons we can take from that period to apply to the coming climate catastrophe, for example.
Sure. So that's sort of setting the context in which we're placing this discussion. So let's have a look then at some of the quite incredible productions that were occurring in the United States and Australia, as opposed to what was happening in the pre-war period.
Let's take, for example, on the Allied side, the US economy, for example, over that 1940 to 1945 period, we're talking about an 85% increase in GDP over that period. You know, a phenomenal amount of growth that today would just be, people would say that's not possible or unbelievable. Russia, now they had lots of other challenges, obviously, because after they had the Germany invaded, they lost a significant chunk of their GDP. It'd be estimated around about the 40% mark was behind enemy line, but even they grew roughly by 10%. The United Kingdom, they had different sets of challenges, but even they grew over that period by around about 20%. Australia, I'll give some other figures around Australia a bit later as to some of the economic achievements that were achieved there. But again, that was a very big growth over that period. And of course, on the Axis side, you know, to put it into some sort of perspective, each of the major combatants, like Japan, Germany, Italy, their GDP was, we're talking levels of reduction comparable, if not greater, than the Great Depression, obviously that they are eventually crushed. But if you look at the armed forces growth over that period, and obviously the Axis started off with a major advantage because they planned for the war and they had already put in essentially 10 years of preparation for it. Looking at the United States, for example, their military before 1940 was a minnow.
I think that's one of the key points here is because we look at the United States through the lens of the last century and we kind of tend to see them as this powerhouse of industry and military might. But the situation you're describing here is one in which they essentially built it from the ground up for the purpose of prosecuting this war. And then you've taken something that people might have thought was impossible prior to, because you've got the sluggish period following the Great Depression, and you're going from basically very, you know, you've got programs that are going on there, you know, the New Deal and whatever, but this is ratcheting up at a scale, you know, sort of unheard of.
Well, so I'll just give you a couple of examples around that. So the tank production in the United States in 1939 was 15. Later on in the war, one factory churned out 50,000 Sherman tanks. And that factory was built in less than a year. So we're talking about the Detroit Tank Arsenal, for example. Another example, the Liberty ship, where literally they were building ships faster than they could be sunk. So these ships were substantial. They were, you know, cargo capacity around 10,000 tons at the time. They had multiple shipyards that they set up simultaneously on the east and west coast. And in fact, they even ended up having competitions between the shipyards as to how quickly they could build these Liberty ships. And one of them was built in 4 days and 15 hours. And then within 7 days, that ships had already got to a harbour, being filled with cargo, was already on its way to the UK.
We will keep the planes flying, the guns booming. Let's all of us get behind our boys. Let's build, 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 and make this a victorious 1943.
So you've got that incredible ramp up of production on the one hand, but also finding capacity on the other. And there's sort of different strategies. And one of them was reducing production or unnecessary production.
In every case, the different allies had different extents to which this occurred. Russia was probably the most drastic, but the UK, US and Australia, part of the process was drawing down the domestic economy and building up the war economy. And a very big part of this, and this is also a very important lesson from this period, is they weren't concerned about how much it cost to do this. That was irrelevant to them. What they were concerned about, however, was inflation. And fundamentally, inflation is not a monetary phenomenon. It's fundamentally a supply problem. And so they were very concerned that as you were shifting production from domestic to the war economy, there were going to be, you know, all these goods and services that people would rely on were not going to be available, right? So if you take away supply, inflation becomes a very real issue. So a lot of their strategies from an economic viewpoint were all around controlling inflation. The point being is that the Western allies in particular were extremely successful at making this, A, to make this transformation, but B, as that production was ramped up and those war economies were transformed, to ensure that people still had access to the basic food, fuel, services, and so on that they needed to get by. And there were very deliberate decisions made as to, like, whether it comes to rationing, and that rationing covered not just food, but like everything, clothing, education, vehicles, everything. And some economies were more strict on this than others, but they all used the same basic technique. And once again, they were very successful in both ramping and transforming their economy, but also controlling inflation.
For the people who are listening, the basic premise here is that if a factory is producing a luxury vehicle, a luxury suit, a luxury anything, a massive house or that sort of thing, then those workers, that productive capacity is not available to produce for the everyday needs as well as the war machine. Are people being fed? Are they being housed? And if you've got a worker down the road who's working on the next mansion or whatever, then they're not available for that. And that's both a resource problem and it's an inflationary problem.
One of the things that they did during that period was invest very heavily in their economic capacity in lots of different ways. So in Australia, they had this Allied Works Council. They created a manpower directorate. So all men and women of working age were just put into this directorate and they were deployed where was necessary. And if bottlenecks had occurred in certain production processes, needed more workers, workers would be shifted out of one industry and put into another one. So for example, banks were basically shut down through that war period. Not all of them, but the financial sector in general was just shut down.
I think a lot of people would be excited to hear that they shut down banks and the financial sector.
The insurance sector was essentially shut down, said, no, you can't operate. There was on skeleton crew, essentially. Stock market was essentially shut down, just stopped.
Non-essential workers.
Non-essential workers. All of those hedge fund managers and so on, they were redeployed. So entire sectors of the economy were essentially shut down and or greatly curtailed. And the whole point, and they were very explicit around this, was two things. A, to reduce the domestic economy and you know the goods and services that were being produced in the domestic economy. But the second, the most important one, was to release those resources to be deployed in the war economy. So they set up studies and identified essential industries, so munitions, medical supplies, food, and all the sorts of things, all under sort of those essential industries. Workers were unable to leave. They couldn't be dismissed, couldn't leave, and unprotected industries, not only were they stopped, they were literally made illegal to even recruit. There were also very strong agreements between with unions and bringing women into the workforce. In a time of crisis, you know, those social norms and so on at the time were also either shifted, moved, or if they needed those resources, they went out of their way to get them. So here's some other couple of examples. Public holidays were cancelled. This was a funny one. Racing meetings were banned. So the racing industry essentially stopped. There was a big debate in Australia around should they close pubs. You'll be glad to know that the pubs remained open for morale purposes, but we won't dwell on that too much. But another piece of this as well, like packaging was greatly reduced. Advertising was essentially stopped or greatly discouraged. You know, all of these activities that as you walk around the street are kind of considered normal. When you actually think about it, though, they're a massive waste of resources and largely unnecessary. So anything that was considered unnecessary to the war production of the war economy was essentially either greatly curtailed, stopped, or at the very least, strongly regulated.
Well, let me ask you this directly then, Marcus. Do you think the Allies would have won the war if it was left to the market?
Absolutely not. Not a hope in hell.
You know, obviously, it's clear.
But another thing, price control was an incredibly important part of this whole process. So, as, you know, we've had some debates recently about, oh, price control, how terrible. We can't do that. Oh, it's going to do all sorts of horrible things. Well, you know, they were very explicit around the use of price control throughout that period. And to give you an idea, so with war contracts, for example, in Australia, they set the profit rate that companies could get from war contracts at a very low level. Off the top of my head, it was only a couple of percentage points, right? So that was the margin they allowed on war contracts. Anytime a company said, oh, we need to raise some prices around this, they'd send a team of auditors in there and go, you show me. Show me the evidence that you actually need to raise a price on this. And they would audit them and have close scrutiny over all of the prices that these companies were charging at every stage of the production process. And one last point I'll make, the suit, right? This blew me away. I was very interested when I sort of reading up on this particular issue. So one of the things they did was that they went out of their way and designed a victory suit. And the whole point of the design of this suit was to reduce the minimum amount of cloth that they could put into this suit, had very few buttons. It was the single-breasted, for instance, to reduce the amount of cloth it would use or material. And they basically said to the suit manufacturers, here, if you want to make a suit, this is how you do it. If you deviate from that, we'll shut you down and get someone else to do it.
You are with Anne and Kev, and we're listening to James Rosier and Marcus Champ having a conversation about, of all things, war economics. So they have taken us into a really unexpected realm when it comes to how progressives might look for answers to the poly crisis, even though we might deplore a war, Kevin.
What occurred to me, Anne, was that we're told constantly that the private sector will drive efficiencies and that the government is inefficient and will only cause problems and is hopeless. And yet what we're seeing here is that during a time of crisis, this is World War II, we've got a climate crisis, we've got a homelessness crisis, we've got an inequality crisis. Mm. The only sector that can efficiently utilise resources with its fiscal capacity is the government. This whole talk about how the private sector should run the economy. The private sector is driven by profit. The only thing that they're efficient at is maximising profit.
I guess what we're seeing by looking at a war economy is we're seeing the kind of capacity and the kind of power that a federal currency issuing government does have.
Yes, what becomes apparent is that that the cost wasn't an issue. It was the mobilisation of resources that was the issue. And only the government can do that efficiently because it's done alongside things like, in the case of World War II, rationing and putting regulations around distribution.
Yeah. Can you imagine a population these days accepting rationing or workers accepting the government telling them where they can work?
Well, kind of, sort of, because during COVID, we touched on a couple of those things. It was still a very private market-driven operation.
True, we've had a taste, haven't we?
Yeah, there was a run on toilet paper, and the supermarkets actually put the rationing in place. But but it was just kind of like, hang on, we need to make sure that this is fair for everybody.
And, like, imagine putting a cap on profits that private enterprise can make. And I have a feeling that's why we saw such a backlash after the war coming from the capital class, because they had a taste of this government power and I don't think they like what they saw.
No. Well, this is what happened in the mid-1970s. The neoclassical economists, the Chicago School of Economists, their propaganda machine, the way they dress this up, the way they convince ordinary working people that making rich people richer is the best way to run your economy is a masterclass in deception. We need to put the heat back on the wealthy.
Can you imagine shutting down the finance industry and the stock market? Like, if you suggested that now, you'd be considered a far left radical.
Yeah, but these are inefficient operations. They draw resources away from what's required for a well-being society, and they funnel profit through to people who are already rich. So much of our economy is geared just to funnel this extreme wealth through to a very few people.
I remember Cameron Murray telling me about the 20,000 people who work in the superannuation industry, how they could be redeployed.
Yeah, advertising, financial products, all this stuff which is not productive.
You know, this picture that Marcus was painting, it does sound very similar to what I've heard people suggest a degrowth transition might look like, where you are shutting down the wasteful industries, which would include things like advertising and packaging as well.
And insurance and the whole financial capitalisation of just making money out of money without any product being...
Without any productive capacity being improved at all. And speaking of productive capacity, I like the way Marcus was talking about how GDP went through the roof back then. And can you imagine they went from producing 15 tanks to in one factory producing 50,000?
50,000. They built a ship in 4 days and had it on the water by the end of the week.
Incredible.
You know?
And Marcus was mentioning that America's GDP grew by 85% over that 4-year period. What that meant was that in some years it was nearly a 20% growth. Now, you compare that with what's been going on in Australia in the past 30 years, and we have not seen a GDP growth more than 5% in any one year.
Yeah.
The wartime growth might be a bit more comparable to China, because China has had some years where they're around 14%, but even so, it's not nearly like it was in World War II.
And the Chinese economy has strong intervention by the government. So when the government intervenes in the economy, it becomes more efficient, contrary to the neoclassical economists.
And of course, we wouldn't say that GDP is a measure of well-being, but it's a good indicator of how you can ramp up activity. And the government, it's really directing what activity by how it targets the spending. So if we want to do climate mitigation and climate adaptation, we could be doing it really rapidly in the way the scientists are calling for. If they're calling for net zero by 2035 versus, you know, the government saying 2050.
Yeah.
So if you look at this wartime economy, you can see that things can change so rapidly.
Yeah, I've heard Bill Mitchell talking about a market-driven solution to the climate crisis, and he just thinks that's a load of rubbish. Like, if you can make, you know, renewables more commercially enticing than fossil fuels, then that's the way to solve the problem. I mean, it's better than nothing, but it's not going to be anywhere near as efficient that if you have a government stepping in and saying, this needs to be done, this is a crisis, it's an emergency, we need to take the following measures. If you want it done quickly and efficiently, you need the government to have a heavy presence in that transition. If it's driven by profit, profit is always going to corrupt the output. You know, a lot of resources are going to go towards making rich people richer.
There are many ways that you can keep up to date with 3CR news, events and programs. The 3CR website is a great spot to catch all your shows via audio on demand or scroll through our range of podcasts. It's also where you can sign up to our monthly newsletter, buy yourself a new t-shirt, or check out archival audio from past broadcasts. Of course, we're also on Twitter at 3CR and Instagram at 3CR Melbourne. But don't forget our mighty AM band. Catch us anytime on 855 AM. Keep in touch, 3cr.org.au.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
Let's hear more from James and Marcus.
Should be pointed out, the Reserve Bank as it is today didn't exist in the same way. It was a subset of the Treasury Department. There was no independent Reserve Bank. Back then, it was part of the Commonwealth Bank. So how did they control interest rates? Well, that was very easy because interest rates were controlled by the government. So the government just set interest rates at a very low level, I might add, and just set that throughout the war period because they knew very well the interest rates, they could contribute to inflation. So they essentially curtailed that issue. And even things like war bonds. So a lot of people would have probably the perception that war bonds paid for the war. That's not what the war bonds were for. And they were very explicit on this. The whole point of a war bond was to drain money from the private sector so it couldn't be spent on goods and services. So that what the promise was, you don't spend your money now. After the war or as the conflict finishes, we'll give you your money back plus an interest rate, right? And again, they were very explicit about this. It wasn't to raise money for the war.
Now, I'd like to sort of narrow in on this distinction because obviously the resources that the United States, Australia, and I guess the Britons were sourcing, they were the resources that were underutilized but available to them within their sphere. What about the Germans? Because you talked before about them building up their military, building up their army, but then they're involved in a campaign of conquest. So they're expanding the amount of resources available to them by essentially taking them over.
Yeah, and look, this was a big concern, especially after the fall of France. The planners in the UK were very concerned as to how Germany was going to harness all these resources and countries they'd conquered. And that on paper, the German economy now was many times larger than the UK. And it was a very big concern. Now, as it turned out, there was a couple of things that were in the Allies' favour, I suppose, or put another way, were to the detriment of the Axis. And one of them, to be very clear, was their horrendous ideology. They believed in conquest, not collaboration. The Axis was an alliance on paper. For all on paper, they had a military alliance. They virtually had no contact with each other throughout the war period. And in fact, in many instances, there were times where one did something that the other one had no idea about that had very strong implications for the other partner. But beyond that, it was their whole horrendous ideology. So when the Germans conquered some of these other countries in Europe, they basically pillaged. So what I mean is that they would go in and they would strip. They would actually go in, for instance, they just take everything out and take it back home. Foodstuffs, money, everything, art, you name it. And another way to think about it is if you think of the economy as being a stock of assets and the flow of assets throughout that system, they took their stock of what they could use and they destroyed it. If you've chopped down all your trees, good luck getting timber in the future, right? So they essentially chopped down all the trees and then were not able to utilize those resources to harness. But on top of that, of course, it wasn't just the resources they destroyed. It was the relationships with the people of all these conquered territories. And then The German economy largely kept running on slave labor, and that's not a very efficient or effective way to run an economy.
This is particularly interesting to me because in my studies of Cambodia, I see a very analogous situation where even though they're coming from a theoretically very different ideological bent, you have a central authority that is willing to exploit both the environment significantly and then degrade significant portions of the population through murder, starvation, forced labor. Obviously, those people aren't going to be on side as part of the ongoing war effort. You're degrading the morale whilst exterminating people.
So here's another interesting point as well that the Axis suffered from is that the early war years, it was all Axis. There was victory after victory after victory. It was looking pretty dire for the Allied side right up until mid to late 1942. And there is such a thing as called victory disease. It's really interesting that German war production actually reduced because they, as far as they're concerned, they had all the tanks and planes that they needed. They actually ramped back some of their industry output to draw down their war economy and even sort of ramped up a little bit of their domestic economy at a time they thought they'd won, right? They thought it was over.
So this is really interesting. So on the one hand, you've got this sort of hubristic idea that we're so good, we've got these victories in the past. So we've taken over these areas, we've got access to those resources, we're so good, and we're also convinced of our own superiority, innate superiority, such that these other societies are inevitably going to fall to us.
There's no doubt that, like I said, Hitler was convinced that the UK was going to give up. He just thought from here, they're isolated, Europe is gone, they're just going to give up. Of course, that's not how it happened. The war was prosecuted by an allied effort, and every one of those allies was critical to the ultimate victory. There's a very strong argument to make that part of the reason the allies won was because the Axis partners didn't do that, and their overall strategy was pretty poor in that regard. Very thankful for that, I might add.
So essentially, you're looking at a cooperative approach amongst the allies, effectively going, let's fight for every inch we have. Let's fight for every inch of underutilized capacity that we have and see how much extra capacity we can create.
There'll be a hot time
in the town of Berlin when the Yanks go marching in.
Lend Uncle Sam a dime to win this war, and he'll pay you back with interest when he's won it. Sign up for this simple savings plan today, and when victory comes, you'll have war bonds in your pockets instead of Axis bonds on your wrists.
Sure, you've bought bonds and stamps. But when you buy this week, mark in your memory, they're bonds of vengeance. Bonds are our weapons. Stop on the way out. You want to say what's in your heart? Say it with bonds.
I'd like to just come back to the war bonds for a moment. What's really interesting to me about that is from some of the wartime advertising I've seen, they're not advertising it. Don't spend money now so that we don't do it for inflation. Oftentimes they're doing it. Your dollar is going into a bomb. But the other point is this delayed gratification. And that speaks to a couple of things here. There's only so long that people seem to be able to want to put up with some of the restrictions that come in the wartime. And there's also this delayed gratification here where there's this expectation that following the war, then we're going to open things up significantly. In the post-war period, though, many of the lessons that were taken were actually the government can do things that we didn't think it could do beforehand.
Well, let's also recognize the 40s and 50s were a period of, the 50s, massive economic growth, but also reduction in things like inequality, well-being increased, life expectancy increased, right? I mean, all the good measures you would say would be an indication of well-being increased over that period. All the bad measures of what you'd say are just undermining or destroying the economy were decreased. There can't be a coincidence or it can't be an accident. And just to reiterate what you're saying, all of the governments on the Western Allies side in particular were acutely aware of public morale. And there's a very strong argument that, especially by early to mid 1945, a key factor in how that war ended was there was a growing concern in the domestic economy within the US to say, you know what, we've had enough. We've done all the sacrifices. It's time to bring this thing to a close.
And I guess that has a quite dark side, because that plays into the morality of some of the decisions that were taken, bombing campaigns, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. If you're feeling like this war effort is no longer sustainable, then that goes into the kind of decisions you're prepared to make that you might not otherwise have made.
Well, look, that is true. And also, we have to keep in mind, it's very easy now to look back at that period and say, oh, wasn't that terrible what they did here, here, and here. There were some terrible decisions made by all sides. There's no doubt about that. However, let's also keep in mind, by 1945, you're talking about some countries had been at war now for 6-7 years, millions upon millions of casualties, and the destruction and the dislocation of people on a scale that we've never seen.
This perspective on World War II and the huge transformation in the economy gives us a lot of lessons about the way we can look at oncoming crises, particularly the climate crisis, but it doesn't map on perfectly. Do you think it takes the big disasters, ongoing floods, fires, all the climate catastrophes, in order to spur the kind of change in the economy that's needed to deal with the situation?
I would like to think not. History would suggest otherwise, unfortunately. At the end of the day, I'm a bit of an optimist. I would hope that we don't get to that point. I mean, there's no doubt that what enabled that whole transformation to occur during that period was an existential, very real crisis of end of civilization, however you want to measure that. And so, you know, there was pretty drastic action to say, well, we've got to do something about it. Now, I would hope we don't get to that point. So putting aside whether you need that sort of level of in-your-face crisis to act on it, I think what one thing I'll take away from that period, and this sort of gets back to the starting point, is that the way we have been told how the economy works and can work and how it could work are two very different things. That change is only going to happen, A, if we vote for it, B, if we have the candidates who are willing to have the strength and the courage to move that agenda forward. If you want the change to happen, we're going to have to make it happen, just as they did during that period. It didn't happen by itself. It wasn't the private sector that did it. It was a bringing together of communities and countries in a time of crisis to make that happen. And I guess that's another lesson from that as well, is that ultimately success happened due to collaboration and bringing communities together.
And I think we can take a piece of hope there, because in the end they did it. As bloody and as horrible as that period is to look back on, if you are despondent about the climate crisis, which is so easy to become, then we can kind of look at this example and say, actually, we can do incredible, huge things in a very short time. They might not happen in the way we want them to and at the speed that we can, but nevertheless, that can happen. Marcus, I'm going to thank you now for excellent, incredible conversation. I really hope the listeners got something out of that the way that I have.
Oh, look, thank you very much, James. Really appreciate it. This is a fascinating period of history, and I think there's a lot we can learn from it going forward.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet, www.3cr.org.au.
There's two capacities that the government has, the capacity to regulate and the capacity to spend money. And so the market needs to be regulated and contained. And then the spending capacity needs to be targeted. And it could be done, you know, the turnaround, I think, could be done within years.
Well, Yes, but like probably quicker than that, because we see in crises like the pandemic and World War II, it's not a turnaround in years, it's a turnaround in weeks and months. Things can happen very quickly, but only with government intervention. You need to have not a market-driven solution. The government needs to be heavily involved, and you need a government that is reflective of the population that it's representing.
Yeah, and as we say, it is the currency issuing government, which is, of course, usually the federal government that has this capacity. So it kind of makes sense that when you're in a crisis, you don't want to be messing around with these unrealistic, self-serving, pie-in-the-sky economic ideologies that are currently used by our Reserve Bank and are currently used by our Treasury and our Parliament, which is why you need to get your local MP to our workshop in Canberra so they can hear about these ideas.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting how the government currently, they're still too influenced by this rotten neoliberal economics, this free market ideology that has us believe the government doesn't have these capacities, and that's their way to justify, you know, the 10% of the people taking 90% of the wealth.
No, 1% of the people. Who knows what it is? The propaganda machine of the neoclassical mob is astounding when you look at it, because they've sold this to ordinary people, ordinary working people, which is the vast majority of the population, are the people that are suffering under the system that they're subjected to, and yet they support it because the propaganda has been so effective. And we on the progressive left, how do we frame our message to win back what should be our natural base? These are our people, you know, and it kind of goes back to the conversation I was having at the beginning of the show. They're good people, but they've been influenced, and there needs to be a credible counter argument to get them to realise what's right there in front of them.
I kind of think we need we need Rosie the Riveter to become Rosie the Treasurer.
she can
make some sensible decisions. Well, thanks again to our friends of the show, Kevin, Marcus Champ and James Rosier.
Yeah, they were fantastic to have James on board interviewing Marcus and the rest of it.
Yes, and both those guys will be speaking at the workshop in Canberra if you'd like to hear more from them. And, of course, that workshop is hosted by our pub night group, Kev, Public Money, Public Good.
Yep.
But in the meantime, we do have to make way for Mafelda. So thanks again, Kev, for beaming in from Taree.
Thanks for putting up with my sub-quality audio via phone. And see you on Saturday, the 1st of November, for Public Money, Public Good. Look it up on the internet. Catch you then, Anne.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, I've heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory.
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalence, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.